Unrooted is a podcast by the Indigenous Foundation focused on centering Indigenous voices and stories. Through Unrooted, we hope to dismantle systems of oppression and uproot the deeply ingrained issues and racism that exist against Indigenous peoples to this day. We hope to share intersectional holistic perspectives through our discussions with Indigenous and Afro-Indigenous advocates and changemakers. Welcome back to another episode of the 21 Things series.
We are your hosts, Izzy Thurston
and Roa Abdallah.
As you may remember from the last episode, in this podcast, we are breaking down the book, The 21 Things You May Not Know About the Indian Act by Bob Joseph.
Yes, and we do this with the hope of clearing misunderstandings about the Indian Act and to really just instill a radical and urgent desire for change within the systems that are in place by you and by us.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first episode, we talked about items concerning band councils, as well as band council elections and the denial of status for women.
Yeah, so in this episode, we'll be moving into discussing the next two topics. However, we have changed up our podcast style just a little bit.
Yes, so instead of learning about the topics and doing research on them together, we decided to collect the information on each topic separately and then just come together. And just with the hopes of learning and hearing about the topics for the first time in real time as we record the podcast.
Yeah, so this will just like really allow us to reflect on the issues that we're talking about.
Yes, and we also just want to make a disclaimer that the topics we're going to be discussing in today's episode are extremely heavy and they can bring up a lot of emotions and can be difficult to listen to. So please, if you find yourself feeling emotional or overwhelmed, just take a moment, take a deep breath, and take some time for yourself.
Yeah, it's most important that you take care of yourself first. And we do try our best to break these topics down into moderate amounts of information. But this is not to say that these issues are simple. They are incredibly complex and have massive impacts on Indigenous peoples today.
Absolutely, absolutely. So with all that being said, let's just get started. The first topic that we'll be delving into for this episode is the creation of reserves. So under the Indian Act, reserves were born. They were defined by the government as a land that is to be used and lived on by an Indian band. But it's important to remember that it wasn't and still isn't isolated from the government. It's still classified as federal land, and First Nations don't actually have title to the land. The reality of reserves is that they were created to confine Indigenous peoples, to contain them, and to control them. Reserves were created on lands that were less valuable, so these lands were, you know, just a fraction of the traditional land that the Indigenous people previously lived on. And they were often very far away, located in territories and ecosystems that were just very unfamiliar to Indigenous communities.
That's awful.
Yeah, absolutely insane. It's, I'm telling you, like, what I found as I researched this is just so upsetting. And it's something that's really important for us to all be aware of.
Completely.
Yeah, yeah. So these pockets of land were created so that European settlers would have the full access to all the bounties of the fish and the game, the water, timber, and everything that previously sustained Indigenous peoples.
So let me just get this straight. They yeah. wanted to control them mm-hmm. and contain them.
Yep.
And use the resources on the land.
That's exactly it.
Sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there weren't any other malicious intentions.
No, of course there was, as there always is with settler colonialism.
Of course.
So one way reserves were perceived was as a way to restrain Indigenous peoples until they became civilized. Now, for those listening, I do this with air quotations and just major sarcasm because I really despise that term, civilized. Now, once they became civilized and learned the proper habits, they'd be theoretically released into the world and would be able to join high society, that high society of Europeans. So essentially, the idea was, once you're properly assimilated and all your previous traditions are destroyed, you can join this higher, elite, civilized society.
So pretty much viewed it as a privilege.
Absolutely. Yep.
And were Indigenous peoples even consulted when reserves were created?
Nope. Absolutely not. They weren't consulted and didn't give their consent to this at all. So this is similar to any acts of colonial violence.
Yes, as we've seen.
Yeah. I honestly, I can't imagine just how terrible that is, you know, to be suddenly removed from your land, isolated into a tiny fraction of it, maybe even put on a piece of land that you're just not familiar with. And also keep in mind that there were never any borders prior to European contact. But then the colonizers came along, they chopped up the land as they wished. So not only would Indigenous peoples be stripped of their lands, they may also have to be separated from their communities. Since their creation, reserves continue to be moved and shrunken, and the land's resources extracted. And of course, unsurprisingly, Indigenous peoples were and are never compensated for all of this.
Of course they're not.
Yeah. What's even crazier is that up until 1958, people who were living on reserves actually needed written permission from who they would call the Indian agent in order to leave reserves for any reason.
That's insane.
Yep. Yeah.
That literally reminds me of when you were in like public school and you had asked for a pass to go to the bathroom, except you're literally asking for a pass to leave the land that you've lived on and with for generations.
Yeah.
Like absolutely crazy.
Mm-hmm. I know.
So what other restrictions did they have?
So there were many imposed laws and policies that Indigenous peoples actually were first forced to follow that just led to a horrible increase in poverty on reserves. So it was illegal for First Nations peoples to use traditional means of resource distribution, and they were limited in their ability to hunt and fish.
But hold on, the colonizers were allowed to hunt and fish as much as, of course, I just wanted to get that straight.
Yeah, yeah. These restrictions, of course, are only on Indigenous peoples. Why would the colonizers, right? Yeah.
No, of course.
Yeah. So now, again, what's even more crazier is that in 1927, an amendment was made to the Indian Act that actually made it illegal for Indigenous peoples to challenge their situation in court. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, my God.
Because I laugh because it's just how absurd this is. It is very, very absurd. Because of these oppressive laws, those living on reserves couldn't even sustain themselves or their families. But on the other hand, leaving a reserve, as I mentioned, required permission. And even when they did leave reserves, they were subjected to just insane amounts of discrimination and assimilation in the cities. And with it, they'd have to give up their rights as status Indians.
Just absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
And absolutely. So with all of this horrific stuff having happened, where does it leave us today? Like, what issues are Indigenous populations still facing in regards to reserves and these policies?
Good question. Yeah. So First Nations living on reserves still face many problems today. The issue of space continues. There just isn't enough land for all the members of the reserves to have housing. Also, the majority of the reserves are very isolated. Within Ontario, Canada, there are 127 federally recognized First Nations reserves, and of them are 109 in Northern Ontario.
Wow.
Which are all far and very difficult to get to. Out of those 109 reserves, there are 34 that are considered to be even more remote. Because of the majority of the reserves in Canada being so isolated, they don't have access to basic services like electricity or even running water. And also, prices are insanely high when it comes to grocery essentials.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of people need to be more aware of. I've been seeing a lot of information about the prices in grocery stores, like being ridiculously high in a lot of First Nations reserves.
Yeah.
And Another thing I wanted to ask you about was, like, what about the healthcare and their overall wellness?
Well, it is quite bleak. Already, the health of Indigenous peoples is poorer than other groups. They have higher infant mortality, suicides, chronic diseases, and infectious diseases. But now, let me just lay out to you how exactly remote living is just even more horrendous on health. First, and this leads to many other points, remote reserves are incredibly difficult to access. Some can only be reached by helicopters. With that comes the difficulty of having proper healthcare facilities.
Of course.
And also, yeah, and also food. It is so important for us to acknowledge just how much of a privilege it is to have access to healthy foods and essentials.
Yeah, I feel like it's really something that people need to integrate into their discussions more. Like, a lot of people don't realize how big a privilege it is to be able to choose if you rather go to, like, Save-On or Whole Foods.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, food insecurity is just a huge problem in many First Nations reserves. And what most people don't realize, and what I didn't realize until just a few years back, is that many remote reserves very rarely get healthy, fresh produce to their communities. It's often just frozen foods that are usually unhealthy and don't have all that a body needs to stay healthy. Another thing, and of course that is I already mentioned, is that many reserves don't have access to clean water. So, and clean running water. So that brings along just a host of health issues with it.
Totally. And I think it's something that people really need to be aware of when they're entering into these conversations about water and food.
Mm-hmm,
just in general, people need to know and have more education around this issue, which is why we're going to include some, like, actionable items at the end of the podcast.
Yes.
So that people can access this kind of stuff.
Yeah, so stay tuned for that, you guys.
So I know you mentioned that before 1958, Indigenous peoples had to get permission to leave their reserves.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, why don't Indigenous peoples just leave reserves? Like, why do they still live on them if they're this bad?
Well, that's the thing. This is something that is very conflicting among different communities, and various opinions exist. A lot of Indigenous peoples don't live on reserves for the exact reasons that I talked about. And when reserves were initially created, settlers were under the impression that Indigenous peoples would either die out, enfranchise, or assimilate into the settler society. But ironically, reserves became a hub of community and a way for Indigenous peoples to maintain their cultures. It became almost a safe haven. And I say almost because, again, Indigenous peoples still face a lot of trouble there. But it became a space where they could freely practice their cultures, live closely to their families, and raise their children in a way that they wish, and to speak their languages.
Yeah, okay. So it kind of became a place where they could be able to do all these things and avoid the discrimination and assimilation that they faced outside of the reserves.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I also wanted to bring up a point that you shared earlier and something crucial to discuss. The Indigenous perspective on land and their connections to it. And just how did the reserves play a part in destroying these connections?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. Land is incredibly sacred to Indigenous peoples. The land they occupy was more than just a place or setting. The ecologies are connected to them. The earth is a living thing. It is kin. And so Indigenous peoples treat it with great respect. Now, settler colonialism and the creation of reserves is just a way of severing this connection and harming it. Now, in the Eurocentric perspective, land is just a commodity. So they took it all away from its caretakers, the Indigenous peoples, and extracted all that they wished from it.
Which is exactly why we are in the place we are today with climate change, because people just continue to take without giving back.
Absolutely. That's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
So to settlers, it is a relationship of dominance. Putting Indigenous peoples on small reserves, a fraction of the land that they used to occupy, was just a method of this dominance. And it is incredibly important for us to understand this relationship, to know that every act of pernicious colonial violence was and is premeditated and planned with the essential end goal of removal of the people on this land that care for it. So the settler can just have free reign in colonizing and using it for their benefit.
Which is exactly why we need to return the land to indigenous peoples.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I also just wanted to say, like, thank you so much for doing the research on this topic and bringing awareness to not only the history of reserves, but their long lasting effects.
Yeah, absolutely. It is my absolute, absolute pleasure doing this research and sharing it with you and with everyone who's listening in. And I have to say, like, it was a very tough experience putting this together and this research together. It is a very, very, very tough topic, and we acknowledge that, and we know that, and we understand if you guys are also having a tough time getting through it and the topics that we explore, because they are tough.
They are tough. and they're really heavy.
They're incredibly heavy, and not just heaviness in terms of on the emotional side, but also the content. It is totally. It's a lot of information.
And what we really want to do here is, like, put these into digestible little bits of information to slowly start to bring awareness and open up the conversation around these topics.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we really, really encourage you all to continue the research and discussion around this, and to not just stop at this learning stage, you know, advocate for Indigenous peoples, listen to them, see what movements there are to create change and help out in whatever way you can.
Okay, so for those of you who are listening in, we will now be moving into the next topic within the Indian Act. So this is going to be the fourth topic we've touched on, and get ready because it's a big one. Encourage voluntary and enforced enfranchisement.
Okay, well, first off, that is a big word. Enfranchisement. What does it mean?
Okay, yeah, for sure. So let's just start there. Enfranchisement refers to the act of being enfranchised, which, don't worry, I will elaborate on it. So to become enfranchised means to lose certain status and rights that one held before. So in the context of the Indian Act, it meant stripping Indigenous peoples of their Indian rights and status, which the settlers gave to them when they created the Indian Act in the first place. So when an Indigenous individual gave up their rights and status and was seen as enfranchised, it meant that they could receive full Canadian citizenship, something that was seen by the government as a privilege, even though it was just a tool for settlers to dismantle Indigenous communities and culture, as was everything else.
So why did the government want to do this?
Well, when the Indian Act was created by colonizers, we already know from the previous episode that the main goal was to force Indigenous peoples and communities into assimilation and impose their ways of life onto them, because they thought they had it all figured out. So this was pretty much just another part of that. The European settlers thought they had an Indian problem, which is absolutely disgusting and shows the terrible thinking, right?
Horrible.
Shows the terrible thinking that Canada was built on. Mm-hmm. So this is why they included this section of the Act to push Indigenous individuals to give up their Indian status and gain Canadian citizenship. Under the original Indian Act, this was known as the Gradual Civilization Act, and it went on from 1876 to 1985, with many amendments made along the way. So in the beginning, only Indigenous men over the age of 21 or bands could apply for enfranchisement. See, because when this all started, it was an option for Indigenous people to opt into enfranchisement. They had not made it so it was required to apply. So pretty much the government was making it seem as if they had a choice, until they also snatched that away from Indigenous people.
Wow. So they gave them just this false illusion of security, right?
Pretty much, yeah. And some of the other facts are, if an Indigenous man who was enfranchised married, his wife automatically becomes enfranchised as well. This also applies to children. If their father was enfranchised, so were they. They didn't really have a choice in the matter. It was also made so that if the father passed away and his children were under 21, they became wards of the state, which had a whole host of problems for Indigenous children.
Wow. Oh my God. Okay. So how many Indigenous men actually wanted to apply for enfranchisement when it was initially introduced by the government?
Yeah, okay. So when it was introduced by the government, pretty much no Indigenous men or bands wanted to take part in it. They
Wow.
didn't agree with what the government was trying to do, forcing them into assimilation and their way of life. They were very aware of what the government was trying to do and didn't want to abandon their culture, people, or land. But there was one man who took the offer and applied for enfranchisement. And when this happened, the band leaders became ashamed. They couldn't believe that someone in their community would turn their back on them. So they felt betrayed.
Wow. So what compelled this Indigenous man to actually apply for enfranchisement? Or like in the beginning, why did the one want to actively participate?
That is such a great question. So, in addition to the promise of full Canadian citizenship, which I mentioned before, Indigenous peoples were promised an allotment of land that after 3 years they were granted the deed for, which seemed like a good thing. And it was a way to get back some of the land stolen from Indigenous peoples by the colonizers. But of course, there was a catch because there always is with colonialism.
Of course, as there always is. Oh my God.
The land was taken from the lands of the Indigenous communities. So it was taken from the reserves that they lived on. So pretty much the land that was given to Indigenous communities when the act was created was then taken away again when the government decided they needed it for something else, such as providing it
Wow.
to an Indigenous man who opted for enfranchisement. So this
Wow.
was absolutely horrific.
That is insane. But honestly, like I'm not surprised, but I'm still shocked, but not surprised when you think about the colonial government.
Exactly.
So, obviously the Indigenous bands did not embrace this or even like the idea of the enfranchisement. How did they respond to this?
Awesome. I'm glad you asked that. So since Indigenous communities and band leaders were so very opposed to this act, they actually petitioned its appeal and wanted it removed as soon as possible, obviously.
Nice.
Yeah. So also because non-Indigenous individuals had to come onto the land to survey it and mark out where the allotments were going to go, bands were even more opposed to this process. By coming onto the land, they were showing disrespect and dishonor to the communities and bands, and eventually the bands just refused to let people on their lands to mark out the incentive allotments.
Right.
So basically, this act really changed everything. The relationship, to many people's surprise, between band councils and the government representatives was pretty civil before this act. It really uprooted, podcast name plug, the relationship between them.
Right, okay. So that was good. That was good there.
Thank you.
What was the reason this particular act ruined the relationship between the band councils and the government?
So the main reason that this is what ruined the relationship is because the proclamation's decree was that the land given to Indigenous peoples, the reserve land, was to be protected at all costs, as it should be. Like, come on, it was literally the least the government could do. But this act showed that the government had no intention of keeping their word
Of
and
course.
that they would take more Indigenous land in order to continue the process of assimilation.
Of course. Of
Yeah.
course.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh, okay. So since Indigenous men were not wanting to apply for this enfranchisement, as the government had hoped that they would, what did they actually end up doing? Did they get rid of this act?
Of course not. They actually ended up doing the opposite.
Of
Yeah,
course.
they began enforcing Indigenous men to enfranchise.
Oh,
And they
God.
did this with the 1880 amendment to the Indian Act. So the government was pretty much in shock that no Indigenous men, besides the one, volunteered to become enfranchised.
Shocked. Oh my
Yeah,
God.
because they could not understand why they did not want to give up their status in order to become full Canadian citizens, because to them, that was like the dream.
Of
Yeah,
course.
the government viewed becoming full citizenship as like this ultimate overarching goal for everyone. And when none of the indigenous men who were offered enfranchisement took it, they were offended and turned to this amendment. So to break it down a little bit, the amendment forced indigenous men into enfranchisement under certain circumstances. So if any indigenous man obtained a degree or became a clergyman, then they had to become enfranchised regardless if they wanted to or not.
Wow.
So yeah, pretty much they were forced to apply in these situations, and then they would be reviewed by a board, even though it was mandatory. And then 2 years later, they would become full Canadian citizens and revoke their Indian status.
Wow. Okay. I keep saying this is insane, but it, honestly, this is
it
so,
is insane.
It is. This is so crazy to me, and I can't believe I didn't know about this before. It's really insane thinking about how little we're taught in school about this.
Yeah.
Oh,
I had never learned about this in middle school, high school, even university. Reading this book and doing this research throughout this with the Indigenous Foundation was really the first time I'd been exposed to it.
Yeah. Oh my God. Wow. 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 Okay. Back on topic. Okay. So this was for the men. What about the women? What did they do during that time? And what was the role of like enfranchisement in their life?
Okay. Okay. Yes. So with Indigenous women, this process was a little more complicated, not so cut and dry as it was with Indigenous men. Indigenous women never really had a choice when it came to enfranchisement. You know, that double standard we're always talking about.
Of course.
Yeah. So unlike Indigenous men, they were always forced into this process, and there was never like a grace period where they could choose. And I mentioned above that women could become enfranchised when their husbands did. And they were also forced into it when they married a non-status man. We touched on this in the first episode, that when Indigenous women married non-status men, they were also told to leave the reserves and their families, which is just terrible.
Horrible, horrible, horrible.
Right. And as we mentioned in the last episode, Indigenous women were told from a young age, mainly in residential schools, that they should leave their reserve community and marry a non-status man. So since this idea was drilled into them from a young age, it was not surprising that many Indigenous women were cheated out of their status through these manipulations.
Right. Of course.
That's all they were. And another fact about women and enfranchisement is that if a Indigenous woman was married and her disenfranchised husband passed away or left her, she was again forced into it and pressured to join Canadian culture and leave her own.
Wow. Oh my God. Okay, please tell me that's it. Tell me there's no more amendments that were made, and that please just tell me that this was stopped. I can't with this anymore.
I wish I could tell you this stopped. And we're only learning about it, researching it, and listening to it. Like, I can't even imagine what Indigenous people went through living this.
Yeah. Oof. Oh, my God.
So, no, it did not stop. There was yet another amendment made to this act. The compulsory enfranchisement was expanded to Indigenous individuals who had joined the military.
Wow.
Men solely. So, this meant that even if an Indigenous man was out fighting in the war, World War II, when they returned, they found themselves enfranchised.
Oof.
Yeah. So this meant while they were away fighting for a country that had done nothing but try and tear them down and force them into assimilation, their Indian status was taken away and they were left with Canadian citizenship.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So this happened despite these men putting their lives at risk and fighting for so-called Canada. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Really unbelievable.
Exactly.
Actually, like pretty believable knowing like the understanding
the government,
that
yeah.
the government, but it still hits you. Like I know
of
how
course.
Horrible the government and the settler systems are, but it's still like, it shocks me, you know, it's insane.
And it's not like the government treats our veterans returning from war with the respect they should anyways.
Yeah. Oof.
There's not enough services in place. Exactly. And then to do this while men are away fighting for a country is absolutely despicable.
Unbelievable. Wow.
Yeah. So the last thing that I wanted to add into this was that the right to vote was tied into the Gradual Civilization Act until 1960. So I'm talking about like voting in federal elections, as we covered band council and band council elections in our first episode. So we will be talking about this more when we go over that topic, which is number 20 in the act under denied Indians the right to vote.
Yes.
But as a side note, I wanted to mention that I'm currently working on an article about the history of voting and how it's connected to Indigenous peoples and their rights. Regarding like federal elections and all of that. So I will discuss the restrictions the Canadian government put on them, such as denying Indigenous peoples the right to vote in federal elections until 1960 without conditions. So if any of you are interested in this topic and do not want to wait for the last episode, check out my article, which will be on the Indigenous Foundation's website.
Yes, that's awesome. Go check it out, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to everyone who listened in on the episode today. We really appreciate you taking the time to learn about these issues and topics with us.
Yes, and now we promise you some actionable items.
Yes, we know we've repeated it 1,000 times. education and learning are crucial. They're absolutely, absolutely crucial in this process, and especially when they come from Indigenous voices and perspectives. But we can't stop there.
No, we can't. So other actions you can take involve holding your government accountable, regardless if it was the government you voted for. So call and contact your local MPs and those in positions of power, including the Prime Minister, as it was his Liberal Party who promised clean drinking water to all Indigenous communities in 2015.
Yeah, that was a promise that he is yet to fulfill. Now, share what you learn with those around you. Make sure that the knowledge is reaching far and wide, and just go further than the performative action that we see every day.
Yeah, and so there's also many Indigenous-led organizations that you can donate to, volunteer with, and engage with consistently. And we've shared them all in the description of the episode, so please check them out.
Yes. And in the words of the revolutionary Che Guevara, above all, always be capable of feeling deeply any injustice committed against anyone, anywhere in the world. This is the most beautiful quality in a revolutionary.